Welcome to the Interior Design Podcast. I'm Hayley Boy, a commercial interior designer with a passion for creating beautiful functional spaces. Over the years, I've had the pleasure of working on a variety of projects and I've accumulated a lot of knowledge to share. I started this podcast because I feel strongly about interior design and the importance of educating designers. A lot of what you hear from us, you won't learn in a course. As designers, there's so much we need to know to do our jobs well, and we want to give you a forum where you can access the information you need wherever you are. Whether you're an aspiring designer, someone designing your own home, or a seasoned professional working in residential or commercial design, this podcast is here to help you improve and thrive. We're not about ego-stroking interviews with big names, although I'm like a little bit impressed by the big named people who are here today. Instead, we focus on practical advice that you can apply directly to your work. You'll learn about different products, their applications, and sustainability practices. Our goal is to equip you with the knowledge you need to excel in your projects. And remember, if it's not fun, we're not doing it. So expect a bit of humour, a few swear words, and the occasional innuendo. Now, a quick note on production. We are interior designers and not sound producers. I am handling the editing myself, so please be patient with any technical glitches. I am improving my production skills as the podcast progresses, and I appreciate your understanding. If there are any editors out there who'd like to volunteer their skills in return for a mention, please feel free to reach out. Thank you for tuning into the Interior Design Podcast. Let's do this. So hi, Guy. Welcome to the Interior Design Podcast.
Morning.
Good morning.
It's great being in Essex.
Two men in seats sitting next to me. It's lovely. I'm like in the middle. Right.
The rose.
So who would like to introduce Grep Brothers? Mark, would you like to give us a brief overview of Grep Brothers' role and reputation in the industry?
So good morning, all. My name is Mark Kendall. I head up the food service solutions of our catering division here at Grep Brothers. We're based in London and all over the country. We're a heritage business. We've been around since 1946, actually. But we, you know, we have a nod to our heritage, a nod to the past, but absolutely focused on the future, new trends, looking at what's hot, what's not, and also working with our friends and colleagues, interior designers, architects, MEP consultants, and the list goes on.
Can you tell us about any recent successful projects that you've had?
I suppose one of the most recent successes that comes to mind is what we collaborated with Paley at Harp Design, and that was Southern Racecourse.
Yes,
an incredible natural disaster shut the whole racecourse overnight with 4 feet of water across everything else and destroyed it. And over a period of probably 5 months, I think, was it? About five months?
It was.
Yeah. Together with B&K, who were the builders, the client, Haley, and ourselves, we delivered a brand spanking new facility for Southern Racecourse. And it was on time, it opened. I think it was on Sky TV as well, wasn't it?
I was flying by the seat of my pants for about 5 months.
We were absolutely calm.
Yeah,
it was brilliant, just calm.
You got a big team.
That's madness. Yeah, so that was great. I mean, I suppose that really shows the length and breadth of what we do. People think about commercial kitchens about being stainless steel tabling and white walls and, you know, looking like ship's galley kitchens. But there's just so much more to that because it's a place where people need to work and they're in there sometimes 12, 14 hours a day. So anything we can do to make that experience better and warmer for them, very difficult to make stainless steel warm.
In look,
but lighting's key, don't feel ergonomics is key, surfaces are key. Surfaces now, a lot of people are going away from stainless steel and using, you know, impervious, non-impervious tops like Dekton, you know, granite, things like that. So, and to be honest with you, it's not that differently priced and it just gives a whole new dimension and changes that color balance in the kitchen. Yeah. So,
give me less ideas and my brain's gone.
Come and see some projects.
I will.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if you want to see any more of the Southern Racecourse stuff, there's a lot on our socials, isn't there? Both of us.
And on Sky.
You guys got the social stuff on them?
Yeah,
on Sky News.
And Sky News, we reposted Sky News. We put our own out, haven't we? And on our own LinkedIn pages. So
Yeah, I think as well, you know, it's finding out that niche and understanding where you sit within a supply chain, like-minded people in your supply chain, which is really, really important that you can work with. And the team at Sunlock had a huge problem. Their business was decimated overnight. And to capture that client's vision in a very, very short space of time and then deliver it in an even shorter space of time and then get it open. I mean, check out Sky News and have a look at what we've done.
On my LinkedIn, I've reposted that. You have as well.
We have as well, yeah. And to the budget that they had, because the budget was dumping.
Oh, yeah. When we started, it was like just the insurance is paying for it.
Yeah.
The worst.
And then the insurance
and
weren't
paying. Then the insurance didn't pay out as much as they thought. Pulling the purse strings.
I think another project maybe one to highlight, it just gives you a bit of a different concept, is Mark heads up our Project Gastronomy division, which is technically at Michelin star restaurants, Grand Dam hotels, particularly in London, but also nationally. And we were fortunate enough to work with Sally Avey. In fact, the site opened a year ago, more or less today, I think, successfully. But one of the key takeaways from that is they're fun people. You know, they work hard. And at the end of the job, she just mentioned that it'd be great to have a disco ball in the kitchen for them.
Oh, I love that.
And guess what?
There's a disco.
Yeah, and there's a switch on the wall. It's a gold switch. And it says, party time.
Oh, my God. I love that.
So it's something a bit different. Yeah.
I'm getting asked to do a bit of kitchen design. And I use things like Outro White Rock. I've got a nice range now, haven't they, of different colours and things like different tiles and things like that. But
yeah, I mean,
we're going to produce Depton on the surfaces.
Yeah, well, Chameleon is the, if White Rock is the White Rock range, isn't it?
Mm.
Yeah. Tiles are quite big, again. There's issues around environmental health and cleaning grout and things like that, but no, red quarry tiles, the old sort of horizontal tile, it's back.
On the floor,
yeah.
You mean?
No, on the walls. Yeah, it's back. But Decton tops and different, it definitely is, I suppose it's one of those things that, you know, you see on the TV, James Martin, all those kind of things, you know, and people do follow it. You know, there are commercial products now, semi-domestic products in the commercial world that started on cooking programs. You know, chefs love them. You can't get commercial warranty, but they're on the TV. Mm. So, you know, you've got likes of MasterChef, Great British Men, all of those kind of things. So you see all the, you know, people are buying tweezers now to put flowers on their food. Yes. It's that funky part. Yeah.
So why is stainless steel a go-to material for commercial kitchens and bars?
Stainless steel is, as Mark was saying, it's impervious. It's hard wearing. It doesn't buckle. It doesn't rust. It doesn't show any stains, or maybe few stains and stainless. It will last a long, long time. I mean, it's a good 20, 25 years before it really starts deteriorating in any way. It can be manipulated in any way you want it. We can design it. We can put radius edges on it. We can put full nose fascias, shelving. We can do whatever we want to it, because we have fantastic fabricators out here in Essex as well that can manipulate it as the way we want it and design it to how they would like it, how the customer would actually like that kitchen to look. And we can inset marble, we can inset Decton, because it's strong, it can take the weight of something like a Decton top.
And what's the benefits of it?
Well, durability, the hygiene, the aesthetics. It can take a good whacking from a chef who's been angry that night. You can throw strip mines on top of it, and you can...
I've just got this vision now of angry chefs.
Never see, you always see an angry chef.
What are
you on? But you can throw your big joints of meat on there. It can take the pounding that a commercial kitchen needs to take. It's easily to clean. You can jet wash it. You can use lots of different chemicals onto it. It's just last. It's just durable.
I think, just as a footnote, everybody, just so that we're not tagging angry chefs, Mark is an ex-chef. So Mark has that experience.
I am an angry chef.
So I just didn't want to claim anybody as being.
So guys.
Mark, he's not an angry chef anymore, because he works with grapplers, but uses that experience, you know, because that's also very important. Uses that experience as he's gained in the kitchen from an operator point of view, because as a designer, as prospective supplier, you need to have that empathy for the chef. Don't ring them at 12 o'clock because they're in the middle of the service. Yeah. Okay. These things are quite simple, but yeah, people do actually do that.
Yeah.
And understand, you know, the journey of that food from the back door, you know, when it's coming in, when it goes into storage, when it goes into its freezer, its fridge, it's decanted into the kitchen, the journey of that food all the way through, you know, everything should have a place and there should be a place for it. That's really a very, and I've stolen that from our sales director. So before that one's for you.
I'm a big fan of chef. Just saying. So I feel like it was like this shift sound.
No, never. Chefs can take it. Never a tough bunch of guys and girls.
They're in the fear breeze there, aren't they?
Well, yeah. They are, yeah. Can't see them standing in an office all day long.
What's the challenge of working with stainless steel?
A challenge of working with stainless steel, if you don't get your measurements right, they're pretty well buggered, aren't you can't just chop a little bit off, or, and if someone doesn't like it, doesn't understand what they're getting from the very beginning, it's hard to just change it. You literally just got to pick it up, take it away, and put a completely new piece in.
I suppose, in essence, to add to that, it's the word bespoke.
Yes.
You know, if it's 1,446 millimeters long, that's how long it is. And if the wall is 1 mil out, it just won't fit. Because stainless is in right angles.
Yes.
You know, that's quite boring, really, but, you know, walls technically aren't.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, when you're measuring something, it's very, very important. Most things we fit in commercial kitchens in the middle of London are absolutely bespoke with angles because they literally fit where they touch. So once it goes in, the only way you're going to change it is with a plasma cutter or an arc welder,
yeah,
which is very, very messy. Kitchen has to close, you know, lots of ventilation, all that kind of stuff. So getting it right first time is absolutely the norm.
So if you were an interior designer measuring in preparation for a commercial kitchen, you have to be really, really careful on things like what are you going to put on your wall before the kitchen gets in there if the wall finish hasn't been done or things like
that. Well, absolutely, because if you've got a block wall, you know, you've probably got a membrane that goes on there. You may have 3 or 4 mil of white rock. The adhesive will be about a millimeter. We've just lost 6 mil there. So now my top doesn't fit. So as a designer, what we tend to advise is let's come in when the walls are actually up. That's always quite difficult because we've got to make it then.
Yeah.
You know, but I'd rather make it once than make it twice, and then it fits, and then everybody's happy, aren't they?
And also, you guys do walls, don't you? You do the white rock.
We're doing it. You're doing it, yeah.
So if I'm sort of looking at you guys doing the commercial kitchen as part of my project, so I'm always thinking, well, you do that bit because then you get all the measurements right.
Yeah, we are a full turnkey. We can do the drainage, we can do the water, we can do the electrical work, walls, floors, ceilings, design the kitchen, install the kitchen, and then service the kitchen for the next 10 years that you're in that kitchen for.
How else do you overcome it? What do you need to know just to make sure that you are getting those measurements right?
I think we're in a unique position, actually. Not unique to the industry, but unique to London. London is our main base. Our offices are based out in Stevenage.
Yeah.
We do most of our work in town and, you know, within the M25. But we are very fortunate within the Grapplers group. We are a group of 5 companies. So we have an M&E business, which is the 5th largest M&E contractor and family-owned contractor in the UK. So we're really fortunate because if you've got a question, there's someone within group that's got an answer on a Teams call, which, you know, that's sometimes that's a real benefit. Sometimes it could make you lazy.
Mm-hmm.
What we try to do with our larger projects, and we would call a larger project maybe sort of £1 million plus, is that we would engage with group first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what services can we provide as a group? What services do we need to subcontract out? Then raffle that together and then off we go. So it's quite fortunate in that respect.
To talk about anything else about the importance of stainless steel in commercial design?
Stainless. Hard to glamorize it.
Yeah, I suppose we can actually, because stainless steel is food safe.
Yes.
Yeah, so The industry standards is 304. So most tops, you know, nearly all tops, 90% of tops are made in 304. So that means
304 is what?
304 grade stainless. So it has a high nickel content and a very, very low ferrous content and iron content, basically. So if in essence, it doesn't rust.
Yeah.
So you can clean it. You can, you know, as Mark says, you could be an angry chef.
Really calm chef. It just looks amazing.
But there are absolutely different levels. So if you are in a small, let's say, a cricket pavilion, for instance, that gets used once every Saturday, you've probably got maybe a millimeter or 1.5 millimeter stainless steel. It might be a bit bouncy, but it doesn't mean get a lot of traffic through its dishwasher or the food service tables. Moving to a central production kitchen in the middle of London, where you've got 30 chefs, you've probably got 2.5 mil. So when you bash the stainless, it's, you know, it is. And then you have bulldoze edges, like Mark was saying, because it makes it easy to clean. Make sure that you've got no edges, so you have 100 mil upstands, everything. You think about everything. And it is quite a forgiving product, but it's only a forgiving product once. That's the key.
Yes.
That's it. And that's quite a big message. And I think over my career, I've learned that quite a lot. Because when you make it wrong, it tends to be rather expensive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Pretty much stays wrong, doesn't it?
No, you changed it.
So designing for efficiency and compliance, what's the key considerations that you do for optimizing layout and workflow?
Compliance with the DHO, ultimately, because they have guidelines.
Environmental health organization.
Yes, to stick to their guidelines, because that is regulation.
I think from a compliance point of view, let's say 10 years ago, kitchens were predominantly gas.
Mm.
Yeah. There's a big sort of stampede now to convert to electric because it's cheaper, it's cleaner. We're going through our green journey as a country, as a continent, as a world.
And as a company.
And as a company. Mm. We'll probably talk about that later, actually, to be fair.
Mm.
But you still need to comply. You know, we need to ensure that, you know, there are adequate spaces in between the equipment so two people can pass by, for instance. If it's a gas kitchen, we need to make sure the ventilation canopy is interlocked with the gas. So if there's a fire or the ventilation canopy goes off, then the gas cuts off. So you're not sort of burning people in the corridors, you know. And then there's electrical requirements and EIC, lots of, like you would see it, you know, building safety efforts, that's just come out, hasn't it? And then it's incredibly onerous. I think there's probably only two projects that have gone through the 12-week approval process so far. Because obviously now, you have to prove that design is compliant at the end of the project, not just at the beginning. So it travelled all the way through. You know, went there and all those terrible, awful disasters. We're in a culture now where we need to absolutely ensure we design it first. Build the building first, use BIM for what it was built for, build it first, rather than designing it on the hoof. And sometimes that happens.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
So how would you optimize layout and workflow?
Well, for shed workflow, you work in your triangles. So you when I design the kitchen, I look at where's the waste, first of all, because that's so key, because you cannot change where the waste is going. You've got a door there, you're not going to get waste in that area. So if there's an existing kitchen, that's your first thoughts off. Then you think of another waste is your waste food, where you're keeping your waste food, where you're keeping the bins, where are the deliveries coming into? So the dirty areas. So you then localize where they are and then keep the cleaner areas away from the dirtier areas. Then, so basically we look at, you know, your dirty food's coming in, so your deliveries all coming in, or then decanted and going into your cold rooms and your dry stores. And then once you actually go through into the kitchen, then you look at your different areas, your larder sections, your pastry sections, your sauce sections, your main cook line, your warewashing sections as well. And then you look at your design and think, like, where am I going to put all those? And chefs like to work in triangles. So you always have to have a sink nearby. You always have to have washing their hands and obviously draining foods. You also have where they're cooking or they're actually working from. And then another area is for their waste and their prep tables. So they work in a triangle, and they try and work within, I'd probably say around about 1.5 square meters for one chef in a busy, busy restaurant. Because you don't want chefs walking from A to B and it's taking them 5 minutes to get there when they've got half a dozen checks on the board and it's the head chef screaming at them saying, "Where's my salmon?" Not all chefs scream.
Don't
have angry chef. So it's one of those, for the design for me, it's liaising with the chefs, liaising with people with the money as well, and then understanding what budget they've got, what's their brief, what food they want to serve, are there any specific manufacturers they deal with, they want to work with, they don't want to work with, and then just building it up as a big Lego jigsaw puzzle type thing. Now, and understanding where you can actually put all these different blocks on a drawing with our great CAD team that we have. And so we liaise with our guys, and then it's just, and then talk to our project managers to talk about servicing the services and, you know, the best places to put all of that equipment and the electrical sockets and then ventilation. Then we go out to our partners and talk about ventilation systems and do we need to have ozone systems? Do we need fire suppression systems? Do we need spark retardant systems, et cetera, et cetera. So it's from a blank piece of paper to a blank room. There's a lot that goes into it before we even get anywhere near really going back to the plant with a brief.
Little break. And then somebody said that Duncan Benetton has died, which we don't know if it's true or not. We don't think it is, but Mark does, don't he?
No.
Well, nobody else agrees.
No.
Mark thinks that Duncan Benetton is dead.
Yeah, no. It's past. Let's not say that.
Also, Mark was telling me about Grab Brothers.
Yes.
Why you went to the toilet.
Yeah.
Sorry, just told everyone that you went to the toilet.
Oh, man, better.
But yeah, you were just telling me about the employees at Grab Brothers. That was really interesting. Do you mind sharing that with our viewers?
Yeah, as I said earlier on, we're a heritage business. So we've been around since 1946. I haven't worked that long, but worked there quite a long time. In fact, 2 years.
Pretty good.
In fact, 2 years, actually, on September the 5th, not counting the days. But going back to that, you know, we're a very, very large local employer. And by a local employer, that's a London employer. So our head office is at King's Cross, just at the back of the beautiful Google building. Might have a choice on that one. And we employ 504 people directly. And I'd say probably 80% of those people live in London, work in London, contribute to the local economy. So it's a great story, you know, when Mark's out talking to his clients that, you know, when you're investing in Grapplovers and all of our sort of complementary services, it's actually a bit of a circular economy piece. And I don't think tell that story enough, but we're incredibly proud of it.
Yeah.
And also I think the stat is that the average tenure of a Grat Brothers employee currently is 17 years.
But the average Grat employee is the average. Wow.
So we have an Excellence Awards next week. So we have an Excellence Awards each year, which celebrates, you know, our people, which is really, really important. You know, we've got people that have been 25 years, 30 years. Our project director has been with us for 37 years. So that's great, isn't it?
It's amazing.
Yeah.
I was going to say, when I went to your head office, I didn't go to King's Cross. Where did I go?
Stevenage.
And the feel of it there is really family. Like, it just feels like a really nice place to work.
Off screen is our marketing director, Victoria. So I'm going to say absolutely, it's a fantastic place. But joking aside, people spend, you know, 2/3 of their working life at work. So why not make it a nice place to work? That's really important. Yes, we have our down days. We left together. We cry together. Very, very important. But, you know, we need to make sure that environment's a good environment for people to work in. Mental health is a big thing. We have mental health first aiders throughout the whole business. We do lots of events. So we listen, we learn. We don't always get it right because no one does. You know, there's always that Friday afternoon call at 3 o'clock where he's jumping up and down, everyone has to jump to it. But generally, it swans across the water, hopefully.
A lot of people do say, as Mark said, in some companies, oh, yeah, we do this, we do that. Others do it, and I've been with the company 10 years, and it is one of those family-feel environments. It really is. I mean, David Gratt, the big boss man, he walks into the office, and he knows who I am. Out of 500-odd people, he still knows us all by name. Victoria as well. Probably see Victoria once, twice a year. And then still, hello, Mark, how are you doing? I know we're quite a few Marks, but,
you know,
the big guys, even Ian and Martin, they still, when they walk into the office, they still know who we are. So it's nice not to be a number.
I think that's very, very difficult to control. Because I won't people can go on record and ask for what Grabber's turnover is, but it is in the hundreds of millions as a group. So we are a large player, a big player in not in the London market, but also the national market. And that's a really, really difficult thing to do, because as you're scaling and scaling and scaling and scaling, keeping that personal touch is incredibly difficult, but it's absolutely right at the start point of our DNA. If we can't keep that, then should we do it?
What's the point? Yeah.
Probably not, to be fair. What kind of that?
Skeptic soul.
So we were talking about designing for efficiency and compliance.
Yeah.
And what we haven't said anything about is balancing form and function in front of house versus back of house areas.
There's the magical science where you come in, isn't it, really?
Yeah,
form and function is really, really important. Get the brief first.
Yeah.
Don't run away with it, because that's just understand what these guys want. You know, what would you really, really, really want? What absolutely don't want? And if you had a magic wand, what would it look like? You know, and take those things away. We're quite fortunate. Like yourself, we draw and 3D. But a lot of clients find it incredibly difficult to read two-dimensional drawing.
Yeah.
We understand that.
You just look at them and go, I can see that.
I mean, you know, what is it going to look like? If I stand in the kitchen or in a restaurant, in a breakfast room, what am I looking at? Because you can't see that wall may be 2 meters high. That wall might be 1,200 mil high. Something in the way. Where's the plant go? You know, all those kind of things. So, and we can normally switch that on quite quickly because we draw base in Revit, which is an AutoCAD package. AutoCAD people will tell me, you don't technically switch, but
we switch a switch.
You switch.
It's a bit like switch a long
flip.
Switch a very small switch. And hey, presto, there it is. And then we move on to SolidWorks, which is another, you know, more detail. And then there's full walkthroughs, which, no, I think.
Do we find those
as Southwell?
I think. Depends where you're from.
Well, if you're from Southwell, you call it Southwell. But if you're not from Southwell, you call it Southwell.
Yeah.
That's what I hear. It blew my mind when I was working there. I just couldn't get it.
That's the international nature of your business, isn't it?
We're far-reaching, darling.
Yes. Going back to form and function, there was a huge push probably about 10 years ago to open kitchens up. Now, let's see what's in there.
Yeah.
You know, let's build glass walls. And that's, I suppose it's still here, but it's starting to move away.
It was in our trends podcast that we did at the HRC this year.
Yeah.
Where open kitchens are in fashion. Mm. That is something that's staying.
But that actually provides you with a bit of a challenge, because if you've got a 100 square meter kitchen, whatever, and you open it, then when you ventilate that kitchen and all the heat that's delivered in that kitchen, there's a fly.
I don't think he's ever been a podcast before. Should we name him?
Mark.
Yeah.
Just
make it easier.
Yeah. So going back, so once you open that wall up, how do you treat the air in the kitchen and keep that at an ambient temperature? How do you stop the smells going into the front of house area?
Keeping it balanced.
So that's when, and ventilation is absolutely key. And also, what happens with the light bleed? Because you're very passionate about the air, you know? because from an interior design point of view, light's fantastic. Mm. You can make things look big, small, hunky, soft, stark. But the kitchen is white light.
Optional.
Environment looks, stainless steel. How do you stop that permeating through into your lovely ambient restaurant? So that's why some of that is actually going away, because it's an extra cost. If you've got the wall up.
Oh, definitely. If you can see it,
yeah,
you need to decorate it. Mm. You need to make
absolutely.
It look beautiful.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's not worth looking at.
But that's where your different kinds of upgrade comes from as well, is it?
Yeah.
And you've got your open kitchens and your decked on tops, your marble tops, etc. So
there is a way of doing it. If you want an open kitchen, there is a way of doing it, because you would bring, to stop the light bleed, you would bring the ceiling down.
Yeah.
And you would maybe... You can have an open kitchen, but it's not completely open. Mm. Can't be sort of like it, almost like a square, so you can see in. People love that, don't they? The drama of that is quite.
Yeah, if you've got a glass wall and you block it off to maybe sort of chest height, people don't want to see the food being cooked. They don't want to see sort of chopping a sirloin and throwing the waste in the bin. They want to see people. Mm. It's that activity. It's about that touch point, because chefs are locked away in an area creating superb dishes. I mean, we work with some fantastic Michelin star chefs, Rosette chefs, and they're locked away for 12 hours and they'll see.
The chefs prefer to be in an open kitchen.
Do they prefer to have? That's a tough one. Some are extra light and want to be seen, want to, I am me, look at me, I feel my wonder. And other chefs are very much ugly. And some chefs just want to get their head down, work hard, and not be bothered by the theatrics around them. And it is just to concentrate and understand. You go into London, there's so many restaurants that are down in the basements, and the foods they can create and bring up to you, it's just what's in their mind, what's in their heads, and they just create these plates of pleasure, which are just fantastic. And they're not bothered a lot of the time by the people outside, So when you get to the real chefs that just want to concentrate on their passion, then that's where they are. Some chefs, they're on TV, they're here, they're there, and they want to be, this is me, look at me. And so when they walk through the restaurant, everyone knows who they are.
Mm-hmm.
They become an alter ego as well. So when they are outside, they're very different to when they're inside the kitchen.
So a question really then, Mark, is which one were you?
I loved being outside, but I didn't want anyone seeing me cooking. So I like feeling through the restaurant and saying hello and meeting the people.
Yeah.
And again, taking advice from wedding parties, things like that. So you'd understand what they actually wanted on for the special day. But I didn't want them to see me cooking it or me screaming at my chefs
had to do it. You're the angry chef, is that
no, never. Well, guys, and so it was a pleasure to work with. Yeah.
If there's anybody that used to work with Marcus, please dial us in on angrychef.com/Essex.
Always a pleasure, always.
So, ensuring designs meet health and safety standards.
We touched on the... EHL, Institute Environmental Health, they have a little bit, but not a great deal to do in it. Then it's all down to the EHL, and there's such a,
I think really, it's experience, isn't it, as well, and there's a lot of it, but, we're very fortunate. We've got some time-served individuals that work with us. We employ
ex-chefs.
We employ professional salespeople. When you're refurbishing a kitchen, it's technically already done. Yeah, but obviously you have to have a nod to health and safety. You wouldn't put something back that you didn't think was right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But when we're doing a new build, absolutely engage with our code environmental health officers, because they're different in different counties, and they have an overall view of health and safety, which is absolutely important. But in different counties, they have different priorities.
Mm.
So what we would tend to do on a new build is we'll design a scheme with the client, with a guiding hand, and then we will send that to the local authority, ask them for their comments. Normally they send them back, okay, looks great, yeah, And then when it's installed, why did you put that there?
Yeah.
So it looked great, you know, so, but that, yeah, that's normally the four. And then the other regulatory things are that, you know, they're a matter of course, building a troll, you know, all those things.
Westminster and their clean air systems that they go through in the central London, they're very, very understanding of your environment around you, of people where they live, people living near the messages. You've got to make sure it's clean air that's coming out of the ventilation system. You've got to make sure that it's a certain decibel as well.
I've gone into kitchens with you where you've kind of just gone, no, we can't use that ventilation system.
Yes, you can just tell straight.
How do you know?
Your eyes start to burn.
Yeah. You start getting headache from the CO2.
Oh, no, I mean, how does Mark know? Like, he's not going to be, he's not working in kitchens. So well, what's the criteria?
If the environment, if you're in an environment and it is oppressive, if it's oppressive to you as a visitor, think about that person that's in there for 9-10 hours a day. A lot of the build, like Mark said, predominantly there are a couple of them, so probably 60% of the restaurants in London have got subterranean kitchens.
Yeah.
What's a subterranean kitchen?
In the basement.
Right.
Yeah. So, and they don't have, some of them don't have stand lifts, dumb waiters. You know, people are walking upstairs, but these guys are locked in these basements, you know, for 12, 14 hours a day. And because this is an historic, then it's happened. But when you go in as a new company to change it, then all bets are off. So unless we can change that environment for the people that are working there, then to be fair, it's a non-start.
So I still don't understand how I know. So if I'm an interior designer and I'm going into a kitchen, I mean, generally, I just phone Mark. If the client was saying to me, you know, what's going on with ventilation or, you know, I've got this kitchen and it's fine. How, and do you agree, Hayley?
Yeah, well.
How do I know?
Yeah, well, we go by the guidelines of DW172, which is a regulation. So I have an understanding, limited understanding of it, but we also have a group of companies that will support us on it. So if I'm not sure, then they will come in, help site survey and do airflows and et cetera, and look at the run and make sure that there's a meter gap between each access point for cleaning and things like that. You go into some extraction systems and the overhang isn't enough for the gas system. So you can stand there and the smoke's burning your eyes, you know, and the heat, and there's no fresh air systems coming. So as soon as you walk into a kitchen, you get a feel, you understand. If when you've been in as many as we have, you just know.
Jesus.
Yeah. And then you can talk to the chefs, and the chef's going to say, yeah, I'm standing here, I'm always getting a bloody headache. And it's like, well, you just see how it's carbon monoxide poisoning.
In so many places in London as well, they don't have a fresh air in.
No, they don't.
And I didn't realise until I started project managing that actually is you have to have a
you
fresh
have
air
to have
in.
An air balance. You have to have a good balance of the fresh air coming in. I think it's around about 80% of extracted air, 80% of air coming in is from the 100% air going out. Has to be balanced.
You need to be gaining around about 20 air changes an hour, but a couple of tips really.
How many an hour?
20 air changes an hour.
20 air changes an hour.
Yeah, so if you're visiting a kitchen and the door's ajar, the door's got a door closer on it, but it's always ajar, that's a telltale sign that the system isn't balanced. Yeah, being a pulley from somewhere else, it's a telltale sign. Another one would be, are the walls greasy? That's another telltale sign. Just a couple of tips. Floors are a bit greasy, you know, so. But the big one is if your eyes start seeing, then that's carbon monoxide.
Yeah.
And it's not it brightening.
Yeah.
You know, but look at your boilers at home. You know, people in Europe who died on holiday because central heating boilers, that's carbon
monoxide. People knew out,
And it's a silent killer. But yeah, that's the last one. And if there's a problem, then you call on the specialists. We're going to test it. We can test it within an hour and we'll tell you exactly what's in it.
So if you're a chef listening to this and you've got stinging eyes going to work, you really need to be...
And you may come with headaches.
Shouting about it.
You may come with headaches in the morning. That's from your, usually, not always, but usually, I've been to your doctor.
Mm-hmm. Or stop the engine.
So your extraction system...
I'm going to do that. Trend and innovations. the latest trends in commercial kitchen and bar design? Latest trends, guys?
Well, trends really. Is that a misnomer?
What's a misnomer?
Well,
it's so just learn another word.
What is it? Well, it's descriptive, isn't it? Because a trend usually follows a fad, isn't it? Cocktails.
Yeah.
Look at cocktails. 15, 20 years ago, a cocktail would be a vodka and orange, wouldn't it? Yeah. It would be, though.
It would.
But nowadays, you've got...
We've got porn star martinis.
But we've got smoke coming out of the glass.
Oh, my God.
We've got a new phrase. We've got mixologists.
Yeah.
Haven't we? And these guys, they're building big drinks in big bowls with cheese and smoke and fire.
And in calibers of chefs.
I love it.
You know, of top chefs and essentially in caliber now as well. Yeah. And sommeliers, you know, they're up there. And
which is fantastic because the bartender, that skill really should be recognized because if you're looking at some of the cocktail bars that we work in, they've got maybe 400 products. And someone says, I'd like that and I want it blue.
You.
And they go, okay. And it's like, and there it is. And it's £15.
If you want it blue angry, you have to pay another time. We did a project called the Forge Kitchen a few years ago, which was one of Cheryl and I worked together on it. And they have got the most amazing cocktails in there. It's in Ipswich, if anyone wants to try it.
Yeah.
Hi, Grant, if you're listening. But they do these like big kind of, it's really steampunk.
Yeah.
It's like, they do these like big kind of things, bowls and, I love it. We've got like a top hat, like a metal top hat.
Yeah. There's a bar in Oxford, like an Alice in Wonderland bar.
A bit like that.
Yeah, where it's all blacked out and you have to knock the door and the hatch opens and they ask you a riddle and you have to pass the riddle and you walk in and everything is in teapots.
Oh, what's it called? I want to go there.
I think it's called Wonderland or something like that, yeah. It's on the Cannon Road.
There's a bar in Liverpool Street called the Breakfast Club, and you go downstairs to go to it. It's like a speedy downstairs, and you have to say, "Who's the cat's mother?" or something. What's it called? The Scaredy Pet Town.
I don't know.
Something like that. There's a password to get in, and you go through a fridge.
I'd be there, honest. But you mentioned trends.
Yes.
QSR, as in quick service restaurants, fast food, that's coming back.
Yep.
You know, Wendy's are back in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
I think their first round is about 60 restaurants. That's been looked after by one of our competitors, actually, from the north. The likes of Nando's, I think they're falling off. They can't build anymore. I don't think any more cities in all towns in the UK that they can build. German Dollar, they're doing incredibly well.
Bregs are everywhere.
Yeah. And look at Leicester Square. If you want to find out what's going on, go to Leicester Square.
Yeah.
No, we did
Angry Crab Shack.
We did the Angry Crab Shack.
Yeah, we did it together.
So, I mean, that's huge in America, but they're trying in Leicester Square and then they'll potentially do the role
now.
And then, you know, fine dining, I think fine dining is always relatively secure. What a lot of people don't realize, I was speaking to someone yesterday, is that a lot of the, you know, I think there's 36 Michelin star restaurants in London, and nearly all of them do a lunch menu. You know, and it's £24.
Mm.
So why not go to somewhere like Murano, where it would cost you £150 for a taste of anything in the evening, and go and taste it for £24? I mean, it's peanuts, really, to be fair.
I'd much rather go for lunch.
And it's the same keep in long lunch.
Oh, yeah, obviously.
£24 on food. And all the drinks.
I suppose what else? It's, like I say, cocktails are big. Street food. Luke Johnson did a few outings. Unfortunately, you know, they've closed there. They were fantastic. The Bad Robot. The Bad Robot down in Canary Wharf. Or was it Eye Robot? Something like that. Which is fantastic. But that allows people to test their concept before they go to Bricks and Mortar.
That's good, isn't it?
And there's a lot of those. I mean, Atta Kutcher, he's doing a few of those. But
in terms of like actual commercial kitchens, things like, do you think that open kitchens are, because I did some research and it said that they were coming back, but do you think?
High Street, absolutely. Yeah. Because it's the space, because you're not building another wall as well. You know, you're in a long sort of,
retail outlet when you can get your conversion in, you go bang, done. But if you're looking at lots of old building and things like that, I think it's horses for courses, to be fair. Would you want an open kitchen? Do you prefer a glass wall?
I do.
Yeah. Yeah. So I can't hear it.
Yep.
Can't hear Mark shouting at all his chefs. There's a bit of a theme, isn't there, today?
Yeah, we should do something like that.
Well, we should.
Yeah, we should.
It's just him in the office, you know, shouting at people.
Oh, again.
Equipment. In like the trends of equipment. I mean, you talk about rationales quite a lot.
Yeah. Rationales is a combination of, and there's various different options you can go down. Then rationales, it's like Hoover. Everybody says, I want a rationale. Do you really want a rationale? Or do you want a combination?
Just for those who don't know, what is a rationale?
A rationale is a combination oven manufactured by a company in Germany, Rationale.
What's a combination oven?
A combination is, it steams, it's a dry heat, or it's a combination of both. And it's cooked by humidity. So you can steam at 125 degrees Celsius rather than just the normal 100 degrees, because you've got that extra bit of dry heat going into it as well. So instead of the food then drying out because of the dry heat, it's actually kept in with the moisture of the steam, et cetera, as well. So it's a fast steamer as well.
So it cooks things for...
It cooks things. If you've got a joint of beef and you want to roast a joint of beef, you put it into a joint oven, then you're losing around about 40% of that joint of beef.
Yeah.
Just through the juices coming out. You put it into a combination oven, then say, a combination oven. Then once you've seared it and kept sealed all the juices in, you put it into your combination oven, then that will keep around, but you're only losing about 10% of your juices, et cetera. So all your flavors are kept inside that combination.
I think Chris is
it's joint beef. Yeah, he does.
And increases the yield.
Yeah. So you get more meat.
Increases the yield, as in return on investment from the chefs.
Yeah. So you're not losing 40% of your food.
And it tastes better.
Going down the drains, yeah.
So win-win. There's an oven, but a really super oven.
It's an intelligent, highly programmable, multi-speaking oven. Multilingual, I should say.
Does it talk to you?
It shouts and screams at you.
So that's you.
It beeps and makes funny noises whenever it wants to. But it's multi-programmable. So, for instance, when the chef comes in and he programs a menu, then any other chef can just press a button and that oven would create that dish for them. They are intelligent. It helps with the amount of chefs that are leaving the business. It helps trying to keep your brigade together, you know, by giving them the best working environment, equipment, conditions.
I think also as well, while we're chatting at one of our suppliers, Mark, I'm sure we're going to get some extra discount. Thanks, Colin. But lots of innovation, lots of European companies, mad inventors making great things that they think are great. Really nobody wants, because they're so complicated and no one can use them. But the combination of I suppose that entered the UK probably about 30 years ago.
Mm.
And the company that Mark mentions, you know, they put them into every college in the UK. So now everybody wants one. It's like Hoover, for instance.
Yeah.
Hoover's a Hoover. It's not a vacuum cleaner. Yeah. But so they did a great job, and it's a great product. You know, they've got 65% of the world market, but there are competitors that do the same kind of things. And like in the car industry, everybody catches up. Mm-hmm. And then I think the playing field is relatively level now. But there are lots and lots of innovations coming through. You know, we go to commercial kitchen shows, things like that, and we'll see everything. But fundamentally, it's about cooking food, finding out what the chef needs, what they need to deliver, and then recommending the equipment to it, not the other way around. Because it's chefs who are producing food.
Mm.
So let's listen to them. Let's give them what they want. Let's challenge them and say, to be honest with you, you don't need three of those. Because just because you had them in your last restaurant, you might be able to get away with one and do something with something else. So that's the expertise that we bring.
Yeah.
And why not challenge people? If somebody wants three things that cost £30,000, why not give them two? It's going to cost them 20. Now, we're doing the right thing there, because we're being open, equitable, fair, reasonable, and
sustainable.
And they come to us for the next project. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure we'll come on sustainability later, and that's a massive hot topic.
Yeah, absolutely. So is there any other pieces of equipment that you think, wow, that's gonna give them? Or is it just all, are they all gimmicks?
In the 90s, the microwave oven came out into the commercial world, and that was, wow, that's amazing. I can heat my baked beans up in seconds. Then, so that's now gone through, and it's gone, very rarely to see a microwave oven in a kitchen. It's now, you've got combination microwave ovens, which are your...
What's a combination microwave?
Well, it's an oven, it has dry heat, but it also has a microwave capability behind it as well. So when you go into a coffee shop, like a big brand coffee shop, Costa, someone like that, and you want your panini, instead of going into one of those little flat panini things now, it goes into this little box, put it in there, shut the door, press the button, and it comes out in 30 seconds, and it's toasted.
30 seconds?
Yeah, it's toasted, no. It's piping hot, it comes out, and away we go. It's all about the speed. But it's microwaved, so if you just put one of those paninis into a microwave oven, it just becomes kind of a soggy mess. Mm. You put it into one of these combination microwave ovens, because it's got that dry heat, it comes out crisp and toasted, but still hot in the middle.
So if you're designing a coffee shop, you need a combi.
You need
the surface.
A micro combi, yeah. Rather than a combination oven, you need a microwave combination.
I think as well, you have to look at the market that's requesting the products. Mm. You know, if you're in a coffee shop, the most important thing is getting rid of the queue.
Yes.
Mm. Yeah. Because as British, we love queuing. Fantastic. We queue for bread. We queue for everything. You know, in fact, you go abroad, and the only people in the queue are the British people, because they're just used to it, aren't they? And they're just standing there like this, and the Germans
rest.
I suck to the Germans.
I hate queuing, right? Yeah. And Mark's probably the same, but I'm just very impatient.
Patient.
And I lived in Italy for a little while, and I got there, and they do not queue in Italy. You literally just go to it's like going to a bar in a nightclub. Where you're like going, whoever makes the most noise.
Whoever's got to be paying the
most. But it's like that in coffee shops in Italy. And I was just in my element. I was just like, oh my God, there's no queues. I love it.
But going back to that, if you look at that coffee shop thing, because obviously, we were talking about innovation, getting rid of the queue, that's important. So when someone's going to the till to order their food, if you look at the way Pret are doing it, Starbucks, but they've got somebody on the machine.
Mm.
Yeah. So you're placing the order. They can hear what's going on. So they've got your, Pret do a fantastic chicken ham toasted on it. It's amazing. And so you order that. As you order it, someone's making your drink, but that thing's just gone in this microwave convection that Mark's talked about. So then your drink suddenly arrives and it's there. Queue's gone, £8.50, £12, whatever it is, next. So innovation and multiple cooking, taking labor,
labor saving devices,
really important in that sense. Is that important in a fine dining kitchen? Absolutely not.
Mm.
You do find those products get put in them, but they don't get used because people are cooking differently. They're not cooking better or harder or smarter. They're just doing it a different way because their end product is a lovely dress plate, with tweezers and flowers and pickles. But in Pret, you just want your flat and white, your cheese toast, and you want to be out the door, don't you?
Yeah.
So that's the difference. So it's picking the right thing for the right sector.
Mm. And coffee machines.
Yes.
You guys do coffee machines, don't you?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, we do.
I'm actually really impressed with the coffee now, the bean to cup coffee.
Yeah.
I think it's brilliant.
Well, the press button.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's some out there that are coffee art. I mean, the brilliant one of our manufacturers supports us. You go up to the machine, you press a button, you want a vanilla syrup, oatmeal, latte with froth coming out on the top of it, whatever. You press that button and it comes and it looks like some barista's just done it. And they do taste great, depending on the coffee beans you use, obviously.
Yeah.
But they are, again, labor saving, very clever.
And also, it's consistency, isn't it? I think a lot of some people really like barista coffee, and that's how that's, and they train their staff, and then that's fine. But a lot of people really like the bean-to-cup machines because they've got that control. The person who's running the company, if they've got a new person making a coffee, they don't have to worry about that.
But it is absolutely all about the raw ingredient.
Mm.
Get the bean wrong, get the grind wrong.
And the coffee's wrong.
And the coffee's wrong. So if you've got a grinder, you need a lock on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because they've got little dials on them. So people, if it's a dial and it moves, you play with it. Stick. You know, if you build, you move the dial. And that changes the grind of the coffee, which changes the flavor.
Mm.
So if you've got a client that's got a coffee shop and the coffee specialist has been in, they've specified the beans, you know, whichever roast you require, all being different things. They set the grinder up, then you lock the grinder down.
Lock the grinder.
Because then it's consistent, because your supply is consistent. But what you have to try and eradicate is that human error. And we all like to tamper with things, don't we? Press
buttons. You will know better than anyone else.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sure I can get that toaster going through there quicker because I want to get out of this for Birkin's meeting.
Yeah.
On the old conveyor toaster, you walk into any for breakfast, it's never set.
No.
Someone's turned it up because they want it quicker. So they don't turn up the heat, they just turn up the speed of the toaster and it's just.
Oh.
And there's very clever toasters out there now as well.
Isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Toasters.
Well, they are, again, we had one of our suppliers come in the other week and was talking to us about toasters and the conveyor toasters. And when you do go into these breakfast hotels and go down for breakfast, they have a standard toaster there and it's set wrong or someone's fiddled around with the buttons. Whereas now you can get them in it. Again, it's a press, it notices the size of the toast or the bagel or the croissant that you're putting in and it'll speed up and it'll take it through and it'll kick it out and it'll be done, really. It's all becoming very intelligent. It's taking over the world.
Is it AI? AI toasters?
No, who knows? There are AI ovens coming out.
No.
Yeah, another one of our manufacturers. I'm not allowed to say Unox. I can't remember. another combination of a manufacturer,
Scott.
They have a system. You can walk up, as long as it's programmed in, you can walk up with a tray of broccoli to the oven. And this AI camera system notices you've got broccoli in your head. Open the door, pop it in, shut the door, and it
recognizes.
It recognizes what you've got
in your hand, and it automatically just cooks it.
You cook it, yeah. So you don't even need to press a button anymore. Honestly, almost gone mad. And also, the hot fridges are amazing. Evarios.
It's a hot fridge. Why would you have a hot fridge?
Why do you want a fridge? What do you
make it cold?
Yeah, and to preserve your food.
Right.
Make it
last longer. So you put your chicken breast in the fridge, it stay in that condition for 2-3 days max. You, with these hot fridges, you put your nice pie. I say pie, it's just a simple thing to think of. And so let's say you've got a site that's a sports stadium that wants to serve pies. Rather than just putting them into a hot box, 20 minutes, half an hour, you put them into these hot fridges and it would look after them for a good 10 hours, if not longer. I say 10 hours, too. They say you can go in there longer.
I'm not sure if I'd want a pie that's been...
You wouldn't like...
I suppose it's been like... You wouldn't like... I suppose it's like going into a fish and chip shop where the fish and the pie is in that hot thing. Is
that nothing like that. This is a bang. This is a multi-programmable unit that will you say, well, I'm putting pies in.
Mm-hmm.
You press a button, you have your pies in, and it holds those pies to that same condition that you put it in for a good 10 hours. So when you take it out, it's at that temperature. It's the same texture. It hasn't degraded in any way. So
and it's healthy.
Yeah.
You think that when you keep things hot for a while. Don't you get bacteria? Well, doesn't that breed bacteria?
No, it doesn't, because you have danger zones on bacteria. So between the temperatures of, correct me if I'm wrong, I think 4 degrees to 63 degrees is your danger zone. But the worst point is at 37 degrees, because that is the temperature of us inside.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that's when bacteria grows, between that's your danger zones, really. So anything after that, you can hold food for as long as you want. Yeah, and bacteria won't grow. Anything below, you can hold it. Or anything below minus, you can hold for 3 to 18 months in a fridge. In a fridge, from 4 to 0, you can hold it for around about 3 days, keeping it in a good quality condition. So now they've just flipped it and gone, right, okay, anything over 63 degrees, how can we extend the longevity of that food by keeping its same condition?
It's terrible.
It's extremely intelligent. Very clear. And it supports all these chefs that are struggling at the moment with keeping staff. It's just giving them the tools that allow them to be able to create what they want to do. And these units as well, and this is not just our fridge, I'm playing it down, but some of these Michelin star chefs out there, they love a gadget. They love these things. And they are now doing them, they're dehydrating food unit. Because if Unox had turned around and said, try that and see what you can do with it. So give it to someone who's extremely creative. So you've had the engineer, you've had the intelligent guys playing around making this box. Give it to someone who's creative and let's see what they can do with it. And that's what they're just doing amazing things with it.
I think what you were saying, Mark, is about looking after the chefs and giving them a good environment. Mm-hmm. And that's so important, isn't it? Because you've got a problem in that industry anyway. The worst thing you can do is keep people in an oppressive environment.
Mm. Well, I think that's across all industries. Oppressive environments can be many things. It could be a bad culture within a business. It could be a really, really hot kitchen. You know, it could be
an angry chef.
It could be a server in a restaurant. It was two people, you know, where it's a job of three people and they're two people employed, you know, those kind of things. So I think we have to be mindful of that. As an industry, do we promote ourselves well? Probably not, you know. Do we have a shortage of people? Absolutely. Is it getting worse? Undoubtedly. It's a real problem, and it's not just a problem for, you know, the food service sector of our business, but it's a problem for all, you know. The marketplace, really, and people like working Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. We've seen that now. You know, look at town on a Monday and a Friday, as in London. But we need to be reaching out, not to universities. We need to be in schools, you know, colleges. Everybody wants to be a select chef, but in our industry, you could do so many things. You could be an interior designer. You know, you could be a salesperson. You could be in marketing. You could be a draftsman. You could be an engineer.
Draftsperson.
Drawer. Sorry. But across, apprenticeships are important to us because we're grabbing people. We're actually having to grow our own, you know. Skill shortages, it's shocking and something the government absolutely needs to do something about. So I'm getting on my high horse. We need to let our young people know that work is really rewarding and really important, and we can realize your dreams in any industry, but we're really, really shit at telling people about it. And it's sadly, I mean, I've had a good career in the industry. I'm only 42 now, which is great, so I've got a long way to go. We've all made a good living. You know, we all enjoy it. You know, no one gets to be the one to fail. How do we get that across to our young people? How do we get it across to the leaders of tomorrow? You know, our clients now are getting younger and younger. They do everything on the mobile phones. You know, we need to make sure that all of our outputs are on readable phones because that's where they buy, you know. You know, when they go to a restaurant, they're looking at the menu and saying, what's the carbon footprint of that piece of meat?
Mm-hmm.
Who'd have thought that 3 years ago, 12 months ago, you know, so it's moving at an incredible rate. But we still need skilled labor.
Yeah.
You know, people that want to lie underneath the fridge and fix it. You know, people who want to go into a data center and run cable. You know, people who want to be a HR manager. You know, how do we attract those people? I haven't got the answer, but you know, I think as UK PLC, we need to stop talking about it and do something about it.
So, we need to inspire kids, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely, and reward them. You know, let's not stop paying people pittances for doing internships.
Mm.
You know, if you're doing an internship, pay them right.
Yeah,
because guess what? They might come back.
Well, we were talking to in one of our previous podcasts about architecture and interior design, and there's a new apprenticeship in architecture, and there's a new one in interior design as well. So, which is very new.
Yeah.
That's really
because back really in the day, you'd go into London with you and you'd work for nothing for 4 or 5 months.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you? And your parents would have to pay for your accommodation and boom and things like that, and the practice would get all your new ideas, all your enthusiasm, and then
performance.
And your training, because,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
training changes all the time.
Yeah.
At times, doesn't it? Mm. So, yeah. But no, it's good. It's for me, for interior design, I'm really, really pleased.
Good.
That's how. So you guys do apprenticeships?
Yeah, yeah, we've got
apprenticeship awards.
Thanks, Victorian.
There is
four. So we've got four new apprenticeships at group.
Yeah, we've got
14.
40 apprentices.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. The reason why, I mean, obviously I look after Food Service Solutions, so we have two apprentices with us, which is great. The biggest problem is finding them.
Yeah.
I mean, we will take them all day long. They've got to be the right people and the right fit. Obviously, we're not just going to take anybody. But that's where the pipeline comes in, you know. You know, Mr. Starmer and everybody else, what are you doing about it? Not just the Labour
government. Come on, Mr. Starmer.
Yeah, but previous governments, you know, we've tried all these startup schemes with the youngsters, but, you know, you can't employ someone and pay them £50 a week and expect them to do a good job.
And then
paying the same rate as the person that's doing the job. You know, and hope that they stay.
That's you.
Support it. And like you say, inspire, you know, and lead by example. Because, you know, the young people of today are the leaders tomorrow. And we shouldn't underestimate them because they will desert us and then we'll go somewhere else. Because Australia will take them.
Yeah.
Europe will take them. And all this talent. Because it's just
Middle East now as well, isn't it?
Middle East, yeah.
And that's
so building the mile.
Yeah.
In the desert. Here.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Back again.
Good now. We had a little break.
Drinking coffee.
Talking shit.
And eating biscuits.
I know, we've just ordered kebabs as well.
Kebabs.
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 Call them kebabs in Essex, don't they?
Kebabs.
No, it's just
right, so we talk about kitchens?
Let's do that, yeah.
Sustainability.
Sustainability.
So, sustainability in kitchens. What's your thoughts on this, guys?
Well, we are very grateful. This is a company that's very high, heavy into it. We're pushing a lot of stops out for it, aren't we, Mark? The green energy and everything. Most kitchens that we design now at the moment are induction for energy saving. We try and steer away from gas. We look at all new ideas and new concepts of just saving energy, not just energy that's being brought into the building to cook things, but chef's energy as well. So them running around a lot more. Just trying to keep it all within a plan for them. Yes, trying to think, well, it's the same, really. I mean, Mark knows a lot more about the company stance on the energy.
So sustainability, big buzzwords. Everybody's talking about it. Are they doing anything about it? Quite questionable, including government. I think we just spent a huge amount on carbon capture, I think, this morning. Isn't it $31 billion over the next 10 years, something like that? Anyway, I digress. So sustainability really for grapplers, key targets are scope 1, scope 2, scope 3.
Yeah.
So scope 1 is your emission, your diesel, things like that. Scope 2 is your power. But the big one is scope 3. So most people can get to scope 2 quite easily, scope 1 and 2. I won't go through all the bits and pieces on it because it's all readily available. But scope 3 is the big one because scope 3 is your products and services that you procure. So from a grapplers point of view, across the whole group, 95% of our emissions are in scope 3. So that's buying an oven. Yeah. It's buying pumps, cable tray, stainless steel, lots and lots and lots of things. And for most businesses, your business, it will be exactly the same.
Yeah, absolutely.
So where does it come from? Who's making it? How many countries it's traveled through the supply chain? Is it ethically sourced? Yada, 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 yada. So that's the huge challenge. We measured it, which I suppose is the start, because we know what we know, and we also know what we don't know. So that's another good way of putting it. But the challenge now is to challenge our supply chain, which is an international supply chain, to reduce carbon and then transfer that into our product services that we deliver to our clients. It's a huge challenge. There are some fantastic European companies who absolutely get it, and we're dealing with them. But a lot of the international companies, because they're so large, the issue is just sometimes you just can't touch it because it's so big. And so What do we do about it? I think as a collective, the whole industry, the country, the planet, we need to focus on it. Is it achievable within the target?
Yeah, it probably is.
We're looking to reduce our carbon footprint by half by 2030 and then go net zero by 2050. You can probably live me out, but that's the goal and the plan. So how do we do that with our clients? A lot of companies are offsetting their carbon. So they'll say to you, you need to offset our carbon. So they just don't do anything. They just give it to you in other large businesses. So we need to be mindful of what we're buying. Where did it come from? If it comes from Germany, that's fine. As long as the products that the German manufacturer buys are bought within Germany, rather than product being made in Germany with all the parts coming from all over the world, on ships, planes, trains, automobiles, all that kind of stuff. So a massive challenge. And something that the youth that today, I was talked about earlier about the leaders of tomorrow, they're on it. And eventually, in the not too distant future, their buying practices will be carbon, quality, and then price, not the other way around. So that's a thought to take away.
We did a podcast with the member of the Green Party, Hannah Temple, who was really inspiring, talking about regenerative process and how to be more regenerative. And it isn't a one size fits all thing. It's you've got to work with your suppliers to get them to be more regenerative, more environmentally friendly. If you're a big customer for that supplier, you will have more clout in the way that supplier behaves.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're a small customer for a big supplier, then you have less clout. That's kind of what
I was. What we've done as a group is we've sent a message out to the supply chain. We told them that we are on this journey. As a group, not just as Food Service Solutions, but across, the four companies within the Grantless Group. We told them, we warned them, and in the next 2, 3, 5 years, if they don't change their practices or provide what the planet needs, then our buying decisions may go somewhere else. And that's quite a hard and fast thing to say, because we're buying products repeatedly, spending hundreds of thousands of pounds with these companies, but they just don't comply. And some of them just don't care. So we have to stand up and be counted and reach out to our colleagues in our industry and say, can you join the journey with us?
Mm-hmm.
Because together we're strong.
Yeah.
It's a difficult one. We are incredibly passionate about it. I mean, a key takeaway from today really is, what is your energy tariff? Is it renewable? Because it costs nothing to change. Mm-hmm.
So if a member of the general public wants to be more regenerative,
switch to renewable energy.
So how would you do that?
Contact your energy provider.
And say you only want to be renewable.
Oh, yeah. All of our buildings across, we have buildings in Stevenage, London, Warrington, Belfast, Chelmsford. And what other?
Dublin, Worthing.
Dublin and Worthing. There we are. Outside. Thank you, Victoria. But we'll invite Victoria in shortly so everyone can see it, because she does exist. Honestly. Yeah. And all of those buildings are on renewable energy. So we've hit scope 2, because that's the easy one. So that's the easy takeaway.
Brilliant.
A lot of domestic suppliers as well, you just ask them, you only want renewable energy, and they will only give you renewable.
Is it more expensive to do that?
No.
That's amazing.
On renewable. So they just give us electricity from wind farms and solar power, rather than off of wherever I'm seeing it from.
Fuel.
Yeah.
Coal. Yeah.
The next one is how we use power within a commercial building. When you walk into a building, are all the lights on? Are they using infrared sensors? That's a really easy one, isn't it? When you open the toilet door, is the light on all the time? Or is it on a sensor? If it's on a sensor, it turns on. LEDs. That's another easy fit. We're also working with a lot of larger clients within commercial kitchens, where we're putting in load management for their kitchen. If there's a fridge and the fridge is turned on, it's on all the time. But when it's cold, it's cold. So why not reduce the power to that fridge automatically? And when the door opens, we'll turn it back on again.
And we do that across lots and lots of.
So if you've got equipment, detects that, yes, and intends the peril.
So that when it does, it's not AI. It's just intelligent. It's not artificial.
Very intelligent.
It's intelligent. So it learns that in the morning, the dishwasher will need to go on first, actually. So that draws a lot of power to heat all the water up. And then the combination ovens, for instance, will go on later on. The induction will go on. And then what it does then, rather than putting all your energy into one big funnel and it coming out the bottom, it drips the energy through. It's expensive, but the ROI is approximately 4 years.
Okay.
So off that 4 years, you're making money out of that decision that you've made. Hmm. But again, it's selling that to a potential customer and making them aware that they can actually do something as well, and it will be better for them eventually. They're going to get rid of the gas. The power's going to go down. Going to be a more comfortable area, and they're ticking that green box.
We would have to bring some power into the building, which is extremely high cost as well.
It's a pain, isn't it? Bigger power boards,
etc.
We've had that a few times, haven't we? Yeah. On properties where they just haven't got enough power to power the kitchen.
Yeah, all the time. Brighton Hotel, we've put in a system in there, haven't we, to balance the electricity. So it's using, it takes it from the TVs of the evening, and it moves, it just moves all the power around.
It runs the swimming pool, the chargers, the spa, the kitchen, the commercial freezers, and it looks at that pattern. And when things are switched on, but it's not infallible. It's like anything. You know, it needs human interaction. So if you're blasé about it and thinking the system will work for you automatically, it absolutely won't. It has to have that interaction. So you do have to put LED lights in.
Yeah.
As a matter of course, you do have to put sensors in. Some people hate them.
Not PIR sensors.
They do.
Do you know what? I don't know if I've said this before.
Yeah.
But my husband has nagged me so much in my house for not turning the lights off. I think I'm going to get an electrician to just put PIR sensors.
Just turn the lights off.
I think you're right, but I've got a very busy life.
Yeah.
So sometimes I just rush out the door and my son is half dressed.
Because he's moving around to get the PIR. Yeah.
So sustainability, have you got any more to add about sustainability?
So energy optimization is what we were talking about earlier. Sustainability is, it's not just a grassroots issue, it's a global issue.
Absolutely.
And I keep banging on about my government, that was terrible.
Do it. Go on.
But it needs to come from government. We need to legislate.
Yeah.
It's really, because people will not do anything unless they have to.
Yeah.
Because it's always tomorrow, isn't it? Let's do it tomorrow. Let's turn the lights off in the morning. Yeah, why not? Because it won't hurt, will it? Because it's only the next couple of pence. That's all blaming you now. Yeah. But if it comes from government and it starts with industry, then that will automatically filter down to the domestic population.
Absolutely.
Automatically. So that's the challenge. We're doing our bit. Absolutely doing our bit. We want everybody else to join us on our journey. And we'll help them. And we have a four strong environmental department within Grattpurpose, and that's all they do. You know, look at our green credentials and help us to work better, to buy better, to procure better, to live our lives better with our vehicles. We employ 504 people. We've got a lot of vehicles and a lot of diesel. We're going down the electric route. I'm not convinced, but we're trying. We're trying it. I personally think it'll be hydrogen, personally. But
you think it would be hydrogen what?
Hydrogen cells, hydrogen cars.
Why not electric cars?
No.
Why?
Infrastructure,
yeah,
is one. If you're looking at it from a commercial point of view, we have some electric vehicles. The published data doesn't take into account that you've got to put an engineer's bag in there, a compressor, a couple of bottles of gas. So before you know it, it's gone down by a third. And if he's got six calls in town, he's got to stop for 2 hours to charge his van up. So it's absolutely useless. It's not viable, but with hydrogen, if you look at some of the videos that are on YouTube, there are systems where there are cells. So you can carry an extra cell and you pop in, you literally put the cell in, and the byproduct is water.
Yeah. just needs an Elon Musk to sort it out, doesn't it?
Come on, Elon. Are you listening? I hope you're on.
Yeah, but he's just firing rockets off all over the
world. Yeah, exactly.
He's Elon. So he's reducing his carbon footprint and then he's buying rocket fuel. Great offs.
Green steel.
That's another one. So we're committed to a program with a German manufacturer. I'll name them because they're the only people doing it. It's a company called MKN. They're actually another family business. So they're based in Germany. They were incorporated in 1946, just like we were. So it's quite strange that we sort of come together, which is great. We do a lot of work with them. And they absolutely get the message in the German way. And it's very, very, very focused, unlike some of our European cousins. What we've committed to with MKN is that we are committed to green steel. So the green steel that basically when we buy a product, we pay a surcharge, which allows them to procure green steel.
What's green steel?
So steel produces carbon when it's made. I can't give you the app. I will send them to you so you can put it on the end.
I'll put a link on it, yeah.
For people to understand. But the green steel that we are now procuring is, I think it's a tenth. No, it's 9/10 less carbon than standard global steel that's produced in China. And it's European. So it produces a huge reduction in carbon. So we're still manufacturing. We're still making those boxes. We're still making those combination ovens, but we're doing it in an ethical way. And it's another thing to add back into the mix. But what we have to do is educate the rest of our supply chain, because we buy lots and lots and lots of stainless steel, probably millions of pounds worth of stainless steel, to be fair. Mm-hmm. Where are you buying your stainless from? We know where it's coming from. It's coming from China.
Why from
Europe? Because it's green.
Mm.
That's the challenge. We have a sustainability summit that's coming up in the next couple of weeks, and that will be one of the challenges we send out to our supply chain.
Amazing. I don't really know what to say to that. It's good, isn't it? It's good that people are all focusing on it. That's how we're going to do it.
It's the way forward, isn't it? Really. It's where we have to be.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we have to look after our grandchildren, our grandchildren's children, you know, that kind of thing. It's important, isn't it? The actions that we take now, we probably won't see the benefit of them.
My phone is on.
It's terrible. I turn my phone up, everybody. Make sure your phone's turned off. It's absolutely criminal. Hey,
yeah, but I have ordered our lunch.
Oh, it's Ireland. Well done.
Chicken kebab with mayonnaise.
Treating our guests really well. Babs all round.
Yeah.
So, pressures in the industry. Pressures
in the industry. From my side. And the history of myself is pressures with the chefs and the staff, and the brigades are shrinking. There's a lot of stress within the kitchen. There's so many, it's pressures coming for the waiting staff, pressures for the customers. Customers want everything now. They want it this minute. And they're looking at their phone. They order it, and they want to turn up. They want to see it. They want it in front of them. They've got their cutlery and they're saying, "Where's my food?" So the pressure then goes from waiting staff into the kitchen. The kitchen then gets pressured. The oven's not working correctly, so then we're getting pressure to get the oven fixed in time.
Mm-hmm.
So there's loads of pressures, but we all try and work together to try and ease those pressures out. And there's some fantastic charities out there that support chefs, people within the trade that can help and support everybody else in there. But it's a tough trade, especially being a chef and waiting to front of our staff. It's a tough gig.
Mm-hmm.
And if the investment's not there to make that environment in the kitchen and the front of house a nice place to work, then you're not going to have a high quality team to make your establishment work properly.
Did you say something about the
Burnt Chef? The Burnt Chef is a charitable company.
Well, it's now international, actually.
Yeah.
A chap called Chris, I forget your name, but we'll try and get the link to Burnt Chef on the podcast. Yeah. But they've gone international. It's really, it's about mental health and downtime.
Mm.
And a lot of people in our sector of the industry, it's really 3 or 4 hours absolutely steaming away in it.
Yeah.
And then what do you do in that downtime? You go high. Alcoholism is a popular problem because people do turn to alcohol. Family life can be affected because you're working on social hours. So it's a big for people to reach out to. Free phone, diet. It's gone incredibly well. They have roadshows in the country. They're doing them in Europe, in America now. Chris has done a fantastic job. And then we have our, you know, existing charities in the street, Hospitality Action, for instance, that I used to be, I was going to say a patron, but a member very much involved, where it was similar to what Chris is doing. We reached out to everybody in the street and housekeepers, waiting staff, general managers, food and beverage managers, and looked after their well-being as much as they could. But you've got to talk. And you need to find that vehicle to help people talk. And that is the different one, isn't it? Because mental health is, it's all around us. Now, who looks after the boss? Who does the boss talk to? You know, the weekend. No, I talk to the cat.
Your moped.
Yeah. Start mode.
It's on heads.
Yeah.
And then.
Running a business is very, very difficult. You know that. You know, you built. We have a lot of people in our business. I've worked in this industry for a long, long time. Started in hotels. I came from a different route to Mark. I've started with Just As Forte. You know, when Just As Forte were in. But you probably don't remember that, Just As Forte.
No, I don't. No, is it a hotel?
Yeah.
I'm young.
So yeah, we've all had long, like I said, we've all had long careers. The industry, the workplace has absolutely changed. COVID, it made us rewrite the book and everything. Working from home, 3-day weeks. How do we all adapt? I don't think we've actually got it right yet. We're doing our bit as much as we can, but you can't get to someone's home and say, how you doing? It's difficult. So we have to make sure that we've got every vehicle possible for someone to reach out and make sure we've got the mechanism in place to see any red flags and look at them. You don't always get them. It's not just the hospitality industry. It's every industry because everyone needs to make a buck, don't they? You know, we're responsible for people's mortgages. We need to make sure that we make a profit so we can pay our staff and the wheels keep turning and turning and turning. So, but we enjoy it. That's the main thing. Sorry about all the doom and gloom, but it's a great industry to work in. I've been in it for a very, very long time. It's looked after me. It's looked after my family. And hopefully I'll be in it for many, many years to come.
I love the hospitality industry.
Yeah.
I mean, I do commercial and residential design.
Yeah.
And like offices and things. But whenever we work in hospitality, it's always a real pleasure to do because you really, really make a difference in that person's business profitability as an interior designer. So if you're designing a restaurant or a hotel, and that's why I work with you guys, because I want to get it right. So quite often, sort of Mark and I sort of tag team, don't we? Yeah. Because someone wants something that I can't do, but Mark can, all the other way around. And it's just, it's a real pleasure to see that working, because everything that you do has got an impact on that efficiency and that, you know, how it works as well as how it looks, you know. It's a real, I love that industry. Like the buzz of that kind of.
It's quite funky, isn't it? Victoria hates my words funky, but it is funky. It's great to walk into a really vibrant restaurant and know that you've been involved in it and it's full.
Yeah.
And the tills are ringing or the iPad's clicking. You know, tills don't ring anymore, do they? But you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's good, isn't it? And you feel proud of it, don't you?
I always say that we're a third. So as an interior designer or as somebody who's supplying,
yeah,
what we do is a third of making that business successful.
Absolutely.
It's what we put in, and then you've got the service, and then you've got the food or the offering.
Yeah.
And if you get those three right, then off you go.
Off you go.
Off you go.
Perfect.
Start it. Key takeaways. Turn the lights off. PIRs at home, if you can get them, they're quite easy to fit. And a message really is that every day is a school day. Enjoy life and keep on going.
Never give up.
Yeah. Is that what Rick Cassidy said? Never give you up. Yeah, that's right.
You say that you've got songs in your head.
Listen always, to me, constantly, yeah. Kicking away.
Well, thank you guys.
Pleasure.
For coming in and good. Educating us.
The driving was fantastic. Essex is a lovely county. Haven't been here for a long time, so it's a bit tight the road, but it's
Well, look how beautiful it is. Look.
Yeah.
Thanks, Mark.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on the Interior Design Podcast. If you like this episode, please like, share, and leave us a review. And if you're on YouTube, please subscribe. We're on YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram at interiordesign.podcast and on LinkedIn as Interior Design Podcast. We really value your feedback. If you have any ideas on topics you'd like us to cover or people you'd like us to interview, please get in touch. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time. On the